let's open it up for thoughts and questions on Nehemiah 3 and 4, or anything before that that you wanted to talk about. Or if nothing there, whatever else you want to talk about from Scripture or life that you need the guidance of Scripture on.
Wait, here you pronounce all the names.
I can do it. I don't know if I can do it right, but I can blast right through it. And I'll just, you know, go with whatever I think it is now. And if you say, I don't think you did it right, how would you know? You know? I didn't find any experts sitting in here on these words, so, yeah.
Where in the world did they get those names?
Their moms.
Oh, boy. Yeah, and where did their moms get those names?
Actually, their dads, but whatever.
For the most part, in Aramaic, which I'm assuming is what they probably have a different pronunciation anyways.
Oh, yeah.
Most of Europe, E is an I.
I mean, I still read it like Sanballat, but it's probably Sanballat or something. Right. You know, it's like, I don't care. I'm still just going to say it how it makes sense to me. I'm not living over there trying to, you know. Now, it would be neat to see, like, some of them, what the names mean. You know, some of those might be important. And when I see some of these names, I bet some of these weren't Jewish names. Like, I don't know, 3:3. The fish gate was rebuilt by the sons of Hassanea. It's got two A's in it, which just makes me think, like, Egyptian more than Semitic. And so, you know, it just makes you wonder how much, like, influence there was from other lands that made its way into the cultural milieu of the people that you find here living in this time. Because some of these were people, some of them were people that had been living in that land throughout the exile, and some of them were people who had returned from exile. And so, you know, you've got a whole lot of different influence from so many different things, culture, religion, and language, and all of it. And then on top of that, you know, you've got the prophets that come in and speak and say, you realize we got into this mess because we didn't maintain observance of the law, and we brought in idols, we intermarried with foreigners who, you know, worship idols, and so then we were, you know, left, we were left wanting to kind of pacify them, and so we brought their idols into the household, which brings it into the, you know, the national, you know, and I talk in the sermon about, you know, cultural wars and all those things. Cultural wars wouldn't have been so strong today if the church had been stronger in the past. In other words, we should have always been in control of culture as Christians, rather than saying, well, that's their thing and this is our holy huddle. It should have been, well, we're Christians and we're going to, if we would all stand up and vote for people who are actually Christians, which I know it's hard to even find them on the ballot, you know, they might claim it, but like, are they really? There's a few of them. I actually think there's a few more right now over the last few years than what I've seen in most of my lifetime. People that are actual Christians that aren't scared to talk about it. You know, you hear these interviews with them and they talk about, you know, they talk about their Savior, Jesus Christ. They talk about their prayer and their devotional life. They talk about these things as if they actually mean it, not as if they're trying to just get reelected by a moral majority or a right-leaning majority or something like that. But vote for people, which includes people that are Christians, need to be running for office. So we need to promote them. We need to support them to whatever ways that we can. I mean, I took part with a guy that was trying to run for a county commissioner, Gabriel Papadopoulos. And I was trying to help get him elected. It was a primary, and he was up against an impossible target on that one because all the money was behind the incumbent opponent, and it was a primary. And in a retrospect, what he should have done was run as an independent so he didn't have to go through that primary process for a county commissioner, you know. But it's like, this man's a pastor out on the west side of the county, and you know, he has a burden for the place we live. And I said, let's get it done. And so, you know, those are the things that we ought to be doing more of as much as possible, is getting godly Christian leaders in place. And then we also vote with what we watch and what we buy. Now, I'm not saying you can avoid anything evil by where you shop and don't shop, because pretty much every corporation seems to have something horrible behind it. And I don't know where you draw the line. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't know. But at some point or another, at least as much as we can within reason, say, I'm going to support things that aren't opposed to God. The earliest sign of, you know, we got the little fish, the Christian fish, and it used to, you know, had letters in it that meant like Jesus Christ, Lord and King, or something like that was what the letters stood for. Christian businesses would, in the first century or first and second century, would actually draw that scratched on the sidewalks outside of their business so that other Christians knew that they were friendly to them. Because a lot of times in the marketplace, if they knew you were a Christian, they wouldn't even buy and sell with you. They wouldn't allow you to be one of their customers. Christians were outcast in that way. So Christian-owned businesses would put that on there and say, you know, you're welcome to shop here, kind of thing. And it was their way of identifying with each other without even having to say a word about it. And, you know, I don't know if anybody picked up on that. They probably did after a while, outsiders to the faith. But we should be more in control of the culture. So the culture today is saying so many things that Christians are buying into now. They're saying love is love. They're saying, you know, I see over and over, you know, first, you know, we had a feminist movement in the 70s that had some good goals, I believe, in certain areas. And now it's turned to this thing where it says, I don't need no man. And I see that when I travel. I see it in the airports. I see, you know, these, it's a woman with a whole group of kids, and maybe her sister or her mom is like three generations, and it's just these women traveling. And that's not that women can't travel alone, like more power to them. But what scares me about it is there's absolutely no father figures in the picture whatsoever. Now, I'm just seeing them traveling. That might just be their travel plans, and at home is different, but I see it around the world too, the community too. And, you know, the church needs to stand up and say, we want to help you create a family household where this is the case. We want to stand with people who are married and work to solidify their marriages and say, you need a strong marriage where you're both honoring each other as you honor Christ. These are the things I mean when I say that the church needs to be driving the culture rather than taking a back seat and saying, hey, where are we going today? We need to be saying, this is the direction we're headed. We're taking back our land, and we're saying that we're going to honor God in the things that, you know, there's networks like Angel Studios that makes like The Chosen and all these other things, you know. They're like, we need to support things like that are saying we're going to put a godly message out there. Please do it with good quality. Like, I used to hate Christian productions that were just B or C class productions. It's like, we can do better than that, right? Anyway, that's my little rant about the culture and all that stuff. All because somebody talked about a name.
But I think you have to look at it historically. The reason you don't have a more Christian-driven government is because the church corrupted. When it was in charge, it corrupted itself or corrupted the society.
In some cases, like... I would say a lot of the Roman Catholic cases where they were had their feet planted in both realms, but like where you've got what's his name, Calvin, John Calvin in Geneva, they were like they didn't have this idea of a separation of church and state because everybody in state was also in church, everybody in the government was also a Christian, and so it's like Christian doctors, Christian lawyers, Christian, you know, governors, like all these things. It was just, so it's like, who pays for those that are in need? The church or the government? It's a moot point. It's the same thing. It's like, you know, not that they were physically the same, but it's like, if the government has a program that supports the poor, it's the Christians that are doing it because the Christians are the ones running government and voting for these things to happen. And so in essence, we're still saying, here's what we want our dollars to go to. We want to help support the poor among us. And so there was no question of who cares for those in poverty. It was believers. Now, I'm sure that's changed. You can tell me more about Geneva, Switzerland than I could right now. I'm sure you got, you know, family that's kind of still under the influence of that part of the world. I mean, no, they're not the same, but it's, you know, it's close. And it's probably changed over time. You know, that was, what, 500 years ago or something when Calvin was around? 400, something like that.
I have a question.
Yeah.
In this, I want to know why it took the Jewish people so long to know that they're attacking, because it said they had to tell them 10 times. To
me, that's
an awful lot.
Where was that verse? I remember it. Did I read it?
Yeah, yeah.
Probably read it earlier and forgot.
It's at 12, verse 12. Then the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, wherever you turn, they will attack you. 10 times to me would be, you know, what's wrong with the first or second? And maybe the third, but 10 times before they said, oh, well, maybe this is going to happen.
But the rumor mills, I mean, you hear rumors now, and until you really hear them 10 or 15 times,
right,
like, you know, I can't believe that's really going to happen. And I'm sure that happened.
I think it was a large part of it's that. And also, it could just be they're flooding them with reports from 10 different places. You know, maybe like, they're coming for you. Hey, they're coming for you. Hey, they're coming for you. And like, okay, I got it. They're coming for us, you know? And also, but it could also be like, nah, they're not going to come for us, because remember, Nehemiah on the way in brings them letters from the king that says we're allowed to do this and we have protection. So there's no way they would do this, right? It's kind of like chemtrails. You know, it's like, I need to be told a whole bunch of times, but I, you know, where I'm like, I'm not so sure about this, but bring me some proof of it and maybe I'll listen to that, you know? But otherwise, I'm just going to think, nah, it's what I've always been told, right? It's a jet stream thing. I don't know.
Well, in mine, it says, after 10 times, it says for all places.
Mm. Mine doesn't say all places.
Yeah, interesting.
It's 10 times over.
Yeah, in the King James it says, the Jews which dwelt by them came, they said unto us 10 times, from all places whence ye shall return unto us, they will be upon you. Ugh, that's so convoluted. But yeah, from all places. What else? I've always loved the part where it talks about they did their work one hand on their tools and one hand on their weapons. Man, I don't know why I love it. I don't know if it's the manly part of me that's like, yeah, man stuff, you know? Or I don't know what it is. Yeah, come on. Which do you want, you know? You want the pointy thing or do you want the blunt instrument? Either one's gonna work, you know? I mean, I've worked with a stonemason before and we never had circumstances like this. Like, we build our scaffold, we carry rocks up. That was one of my jobs. You wonder why my back's in bad shape. You know, carrying big old 100 to 200 pound rocks up the scaffold. Because we had a tractor, but it only lived so far, and some of these walls were 40 feet high that we'd be on, and that's a lot of scaffold, by the way. It's scary. And you got to carry the boards up, you got to set it all up. It's a lot of work. And we're up there. And then in the wintertime, it was in Michigan, in the wintertime, we would put these tarps that had the nylon webbing through, and we just arch it all the way down over the whole thing and put this propane heater in the bottom, and it'd warm it up. You'd be just working in, like, just long shirt sleeves in the wintertime and working hard in there, you know, hard stuff. Nobody came to attack us, you know. It was just hammers and chisels and trowels and things like that, but we didn't have to defend ourselves against anyone. I can't imagine doing that and fighting people off, you know?
That's what I was going to say. Wouldn't it would slow down their work a little bit, though, too, wouldn't it?
I mean, I would guess so, but they seem to be going pretty fast. I guess if you know you're going to get attacked, you're trying to hurry up and finish. Hurry up and go.
Yeah, but it's kind of hard to use a shovel with one hand.
That's what I mean.
Once that we're, you know, when you pick up a rock, I'm assuming these are fairly nice sized rocks.
It might be a little metaphorical, like, you
right.
know,
I could see the sword in the rock, you know, around the builders, but
I mean, he might have been kind of metaphorically saying a trowel in one hand and a sword in the other. It might have just been saying, like, they're just as ready to draw the sword as they were to use the trowel.
And when they needed both hands, they'd lay their sword down by
their
feet.
They wore their sword.
Yeah, they wore their swords like they're ready to go to war.
Yeah,
but also, I mean, the spiritual side of this to me is the fact that he had people on the, you know, on the walls, you know, stationed at the ready. And they had people, you know, Nehemiah kept the trumpeter with him, ready to sound the alert, the battle cry. And we've got to have those watchmen. What was it? Who was the watchman on the wall? Was that Ezekiel that talked about the watchman on the wall? Yeah. And God had called him to be that watchman, and he's like, you're out here looking for the incoming threats. We don't put watchmen on the walls, you know, because we don't have the same setup that they did. But I mean, there's somebody that their job is to be stationed at different lookout points along the wall, and they're the ones that are supposed to see the threat as it's coming in, and they report it, and they sound the battle cry or the security alarm for it.
Reading ahead on that.
Yeah.
Do they ever have to use the weapons?
I can only assume that they did, but it doesn't directly say, like, we killed this many people.
I think that we've used prayer. Nehemiah used prayer.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they used the weapons as precautionary. Mm-hmm. If the Lord could handle confusing all these people, that's what he kind of did when they were going to do something, wasn't it? Did I misunderstand that?
Kind of turned their hearts against the baby.
Yeah, kind of confused them.
Yeah.
Then they didn't really have to use the weapons. They were just for show and tell.
It seems that way. So
we put that trust in the Lord.
I've been following the political happenings of this presidency more than I ever have with anyone else before, more than I did the first time Trump was in office. And the main reason is, I want to make sure that he's actually doing the things that he said he's going to do on certain things and not overstepping those bounds of what should happen, because a lot of people accuse that. But here's what I'm thinking. There's a lot of stuff that man takes a lot of flack for, but it's like I'm just sitting back and I'm watching, because I believe there are certain things that he says very strongly towards other nations, especially with some of the ones he's trying to broker peace deals with. And then also some of the things where he's like doing these like threats of tariffs and following through on it on some of them, but willing to change. And like, I know there's a whole, like, I'm not an economist. I don't know about tariffs this way or that. I don't really care. What I have seen is it's like, we're going to do this. And they're like, hey, please don't do that. He's like, okay, well then do these things that we told you to do. And then all of a sudden they're like, all right, you got it. You know, and it's like, I think he was willing to follow through on it. I think this country has always been willing to use our war machine, sometimes way more than we ever should have. But we're willing to use our war machine. But most of us would rather see peace. And wasn't it Teddy Roosevelt that said, walk softly and carry a big stick?
Yes.
I think that's what we're seeing again, but it's just our stick is a whole lot different and bigger, with a whole lot more nuclear power behind it. And that's scary. I mean, it really is. Like, I've read Annie Jacobson's books about this stuff. If you never heard her, it's like, oh my goodness. You know, if this nuclear thing kicks off, it's just over for everyone in a matter of minutes. So don't even worry about what it'll be like to survive it. It ain't happening. And yet I think nobody, Russia, United States, you know, none of us want to use, there's actually, I think, eight nuclear nations in the world that have, like, nuclear weapons, I think. I don't think any of them are really too worried about it, and that's why we're so worried that North Korea and Iran would go nuclear, because we think they would be willing to do it. And so it's like, okay, let's curtail that as much as possible. But I think what we end up seeing is, you know, man, having that threat of force and being willing to do it with... hopefully just with anything, not including nuclear weapons, you know. Like, boy, we need to find a way to get rid of those in our world in general. It's just bad news. But being willing to fight and fight it victoriously really scares the enemy from attacking. And I think I see that in the leadership that we have from the president through his cabinet on down. It's kind of like, call my bluff and see. But that's how I see it working out today. But I think that that's what was going on with Nehemiah and the Israelites. They thought they had a weak fight in the Jews. They thought they would just be able to steamroll over them. And the Jews said, no, we'll fight you while we're working. Okay? Like, I won't even stop working while I fight you. By the way, we've got a wall, so it's easier and easier to do that when we build the wall.
I like work hard, and I will protect what I'm working for.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you've got something worth protecting now. Before that, and see, the thing that you'll see through the rest of Nehemiah, and if you read parts of Ezra too, what you see is that these people that were opposed to God and God's people had free access in and out of Jerusalem. And they wanted to influence what was going on there. When Nehemiah ends up finishing his work, goes back to serve the king, and then after a while, they think a year or two, comes back for a visit, and this is the last couple chapters of Nehemiah. To use a modern phrase, it's lit. I mean, it is absolutely amazing what he does to them. He just goes on this rampage, and I love it. I'm not even going to tell you. You've got to read it for yourself or wait until I get to that week. But he just goes on a rampage against these people and says, like, are you serious? Like, why are you doing all these things, you know? And so he goes crazy, but it's because he's like, you know, you guys are bringing in you're bringing in you're allowing vendors to bring in their loads on the Sabbath day and start selling on the Sabbath again. Like, why are we doing this? Close the gates. Close them down the night before. And then when they still keep showing up, he's like, go away. Don't, if you guys show up here, I will beat you. Like, he's like, I'll be a one-man army. I don't care. I'll whoop some tail. Quit coming here and camping out outside the gate, just waiting for sun up the day after Sabbath day. He's like, that's not how this works. We're not just only worshiping God a little bit as if just barely following the rules is good enough. We actually are serious about the Sabbath day here. Now keep it holy and get out of here or I'll beat you. It's just like, you know, you're either going to serve God or get beaten. I mean, it's like the old shirt that said beating will continue until morale improves. You know, it's like, I'll make sure you're worshiping God or I'll fight you until you do. Just, I don't know if it works, but that's how Nehemiah did it. And then he said, God, remember me. I tried really hard. It's like, yes. So anyway, he did some premeditated stuff too. I mean, he pulled out beard hairs. You don't just accidentally do that. Like, he ripped the beards out of guys' faces. I told you anyway. I told you had to read it for yourself. Anyway, it's so good. It's so good. I think every pastor's had a list of people that he's wanted to do that to. I'm just kidding. Anyway. I mean, he punched some of them in the face, you know, like this closed fist punching for disobeying God because they had built something that was worth protecting. And after building their walls and keeping the enemy out, the demonic forces of evil were still able to get inside the city through the hearts of men. And as they did that, it turns out that the walls weren't the only thing that kept them secure in their faith. Their hearts had to be there too. Because that's why Nehemiah is going to fight them. Like, if you won't listen to what I said before, then you're going to feel the pain of it. Maybe that'll start you to think. If somebody punches me in the face, that'll really stop me in my tracks for a minute. I'll be like, I didn't do anything to deserve that, I think. Why are you punching me, you know? So,
but you know, we still do that today. And I'm going to take the vendors that were coming in to sell goods.
Yeah.
If you take that and make them the drug dealers, we're saying, okay, you can't bring these drugs in because you're bringing our society down. If there were not a demand, there would not be a supply.
Right.
So admonishing the seller is counterproductive if you look at supply and demand economics.
Yeah.
You need to get rid of the demand.
Yes.
And so Nehemiah really needed to go to the people in Jerusalem and say, look, you don't need these goods on the Sabbath.
Yeah.
You don't need to buy them.
Absolutely.
And so I think it's easier to blame the seller.
It is.
Then to address the real problem, which is the demand is there. And
true.
We can't change that.
But if you stop the supply, then the people that were demanding it
will either leave to go find it or.
Or you can go to the Chinese answer, which is what they did during the Opium Wars, and said, look, you want it, we'll give you all you want. Go in the den, smoke your opium. When you die, to the ground. And the problem is solved because the people who are demanding the service aren't there anymore. And so you can see it both ways.
Yeah. I mean, I've never beaten down the door at Hobby Lobby on Sunday trying to, you know, say, sell me something. Mm-hmm. When they decided to close down, it forces me not to even be tempted to go buy anything. So I see what you're saying. It does go both ways. But if we shut down the supplier, then eventually we're all going to be forced to, I guess I've got to prepare the day before. If I need to do some craft on Sunday or Monday, I guess I really got to prepare for that by going there on Saturday.
I think it's easier to get rid of the supplier
But it's also easier, let's see, one supplier might have 100 customers or whatever, you know, whatever the ratio would be. And so it's like those 100 people might just be tempted to do business on the Sabbath day because it's easy and convenient for them. And they are not working. Like when you're buying, you're not the one working. The sellers are. And so they are breaking the Sabbath by doing their work on the Sabbath day. And that might be considered the greater offense or evil in God's eyes because, you know, they open their shop, they're doing their work on the Sabbath. The poor schmuck that came to buy something from them might have just been walking down to their friend's house for Sunday or Sabbath day lunch and said, oh, I need to buy a tchotchke from you, you know, or whatever it is. You know, let's wrap up with this. So like our conundrum today on that front would be, you know, it's lunchtime now, it's noon, we're gonna leave from here. Do you have a meal planned at home? Or are you thinking, oh, you know, restaurants are open, let's go to the restaurant. Those restaurants are going to be open as long as we demand them to be open. But if we all said, you know what, how many of those people that had to go to work today couldn't be in church service because we only have church services during the days that they're open? You know, we don't have another option for them. And they're going to keep showing up to work as long as we keep buying their meals. But if we actually were serious about wanting to invite them to church, we probably wouldn't be eating there right now. That was something that me and my family had to, you know, decide in our lives a while back within the last year or so. Is I said, you know, I've been complicit in forcing people to work. Now, it's not just my little bit of money, my couple meals for my family that's doing it, but I mean, overall, we the church, and so this is kind of what you're saying, like, let's shut down the demand. We're demanding restaurants be open, essentially, because that's easier for us on a Sunday. But it's also keeping people from coming to hear the word. So am I going to continue creating that demand, or am I going to, you know, make a move with my car and my wallet and my family's, you know, thing and say, I'm going to put some meat out of the freezer on Saturday, you know, thaw some meat or prepare something in advance or what have you, which is generally what we've been doing. I don't have a hard and fast rule on it because I also leave the opportunity open if there's somebody that was a visitor or some reason I need to meet with someone, and Sunday's the day to do it. Sometimes the restaurant's the easiest way for that to happen. You know, we don't have like a big dining table in our house, you know, stuff like that. So it's like sometimes that's the way to do it. So we might just do it that way. So again, I'm not legalistic about it, but I do try. That's something that we've been doing in our family that we've been trying to do. I can't point to a scripture verse and say, you have to do it the same way. I'm just telling you where we're at in our household, and say, you know what, there is another way. There's 6 days out of the week that I can go to a restaurant if I need to. And on Sundays, there's something nice about just going home and being with our family or occasionally having a couple folks over and not forcing somebody to work that day. Yep, good stuff.